Nick Hawkes from political think tank Reuters and Professor Edge from Oxford Brookes University want to talk about reform of Legislative Council. Perspective this week asks them why. How does tinkering with our parliamentary structures help address the housing crisis, cost of living crisis, and the difficulties faced by the hospitality sector? Seasoned political commentator Alistair Ramsay has seen it all before, and publicly active LegCo member Tanya August Hansen just wants to get on with the job. They join me now in the studio. Nick Hawkes, perhaps if you could begin by explaining why Reuters thinks that now is a good time to investigate or to consider the constitutional position of the Legislative Council.
Well, it's always a good time to talk about the Constitution. For us, the Constitution is a really important part of Manx politics. A lot of people have misconceptions about what the Constitution actually is and what it means. Quite often it's framed as independence or something that's binary. But actually the Constitution and talking about the Constitution is really important to all aspects of policy making, from elections to representation to how we actually make policy. So we've come together with Professor Peter Edge from Oxford Brookes University to host an event looking at alternative setups for the Isle of Man's Parliament, and looking predominantly at the functions and features of LegCo and comparing that with other small countries around the world.
There will be many people who will say we have a housing crisis, we have a cost of living crisis, we've got the hospitality sector on its knees. Can we really afford the luxury of political navel-gazing into structures and the constitutional setup of our parliament?
I would directly counter that and say that we can't afford not to look at the Constitution. We've had an evolving sort of constitutional setup over the years, but many of the issues that we're facing are direct products of our constitutional setup, of the structure of Tynwald, the function of government, the changes to the ministerial system, the structure of Legislative Council and the Keys. If we keep on expecting to get different results with the same system, then we're going to be doomed to fail. So we need to look and take a fresh look and take a step back and look at the structure of our government and the structure of our parliament.
So Tanya, it's all your fault then?
It's all Legislative Council's fault. I think it's one part of a much bigger system. The Legislative Council has its functions at the moment. We're populating a lot of government departments, but we're also playing quite a big, heavy role in Parliament as well. I do think, though, that if we're going to look at Legislative Council, you need to also look at Keys. Keys is very, very important. And we're saying, you know, it is the most important of the two branches, and because it's the directly elected branch. So if we're going to look at it, my suggestion would be that you look at all of it, not part of it. You know, it's Legislative Council. Over the course of like the last few years, particularly since I was elected, we've also made a lot of internal reforms as well to ourselves. We've got a business and functioning of Legislative Council Standing Committee. We meet every week to discuss council business, to ask where the legislation across government is up to, why things aren't being brought forward. And also to sort of like arrange our time where we do have legislation coming forward, and we've just introduced post-legislative scrutiny into our branch, which is also supported by the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. So there's an awful lot of things that are going on. We've recently changed our standing orders as well to make sure that, you know, this idea that Legislative Council would be some rubber stamping mechanism for government legislation, that is no longer, I believe, the case at all. We have the means by which we can delay further and take evidence on pieces of legislation to make sure that it's the right fit and it's engineered correctly for the Isle of Man.
Peter, academics don't tend to involve themselves in upsetting the constitutional apple cart. Why did you think it was a good idea to get involved with Reuters and hold this event?
Yeah, I think that's a really old-fashioned view of universities. Universities are really, really keen for the work and expertise that they have to actually contribute to the broader public good. You know, it's not just us navel-gazing and sitting and talking to each other. It is a matter of us reaching out to people and having more extensive dialogues. So that's part of the reason for me doing that. The other thing is I've recently finished quite a big research project which has looked at Legislative Council really from 1919 up to the present day. And I actually end up arguing that when you compare it with bicameralism in other small democracies, so around the world, a lot of them UK heritage, but around the world, actually the post 2010 2017 version of the MLC, of the Legislative Council, is really, really good. And if you're going to have bicameralism in a small democracy, the Manx model is one that I think should actively be looked at by other small democracies, which I know won't get on terribly well with people who think that it's an incredibly weird and ineffective structure, but it's a really good way of creating a second chamber. But when I finished that project, I realised the thing that I hadn't really addressed is, should you have a second chamber in the first place? You know, if the Manx model is really good for a second chamber, why is it that most small democracies don't have two chambers? They're what we call unicameral. And unicameralism is much more common in small democracies than it is in larger democracies. So one of the things that we wanted to talk about with people really is that fundamental question about unicameralism, bicameralism. I won't get into the whole tricameral debate, but, you know, two different chambers of legislators. And I think Tanya is absolutely right that if you begin to think about unicameralism, you have to think about Tynwald as a whole. You know, if you make significant changes to the Legislative Council, you need to think about the knock-on effect in the Keys. And one of the things that you see looking at some other small democracies is they are unicameral, but they have different ways of people entering that chamber. So it's not just all the same franchise. Whereas other small democracies, they all have the same franchise, like Guernsey since 2020, for instance.
Well, we'll come back to the history, but perhaps now's a good time to bring in seasoned political commentator Alistair Ramsay. Alistair, there's often a phrase trotted out, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Is it broke? Does it need fixing?
Yes, I would agree that we need to look at this kind of holistically, the whole system, and I still think it there are imbalances in the system that need addressing. I think a LegCo can be part of that solution and providing more challenge and more scrutiny and being more detached from the work of the executive, because the House of Keys is heavily dominated by the executive. So I think we should be building in more formally the kind of scrutiny and challenge role, not just on the detail of legislation, but actually in the way that policy is presented and prepared, and the extent to which government presents thorough business cases for some of its fairly radical policy decisions. But I mean, I must say that it's great to see Rietus coming into being and providing that kind of think tank. So, because we don't have an awful lot of think tanks, or sometimes not an awful lot of thought. But they...
So why could the House of Keys not just do all this? I mean, the time that's spent in House of Keys is answering questions which many members could have answered if they just picked up the phone and spoke to someone. What surely, if they focused a little bit more on legislation, they could fulfil the scrutiny function, the legislative scrutiny function in the House of Keys.
Well, for a start, I mean, they're a very small chamber, and they are heavily, you know, most of the members are tied up in one way or another with the executive. So it's a question of perspective, but also, you know, a small chamber perhaps doesn't have that weight of scrutiny. So there's certainly no harm, and there's a real benefit in having that second look, that pause.
Well, I suppose that the harm that many people might see is that across the public service, we've seen savage cuts in many areas over the last decade and a half. The only place that doesn't seem to have been touched is the Parliament. I mean, Nick, is there a case to just have a unicameral one Parliament House of Keys without the encumbrance of LegCo?
I think making a sweeping statement here today is not what Rietis is about, saying that we believe in unicameralism. I completely agree with Peter and Tanya that and Alistair that we need to take a holistic view of how our parliamentary system and government operates. That's how we get the best policy. There is definitely a case for unicameralism. You know, we've seen in other small jurisdictions and countries around the world how unicameralism operates. It's a very different system to what we have. And we have a lot of kind of institutional knowledge over years and years that is built up based around our system and how it operates. It would be a huge change for government. It would be a huge change for legislators. It would be an enormous change for the public as well, although they might not feel it. We don't think that going into that, you know, just with the say we want to have unicameralism, that's the best way to go. What we would say is it needs to be focused on what is the best for policy delivery, what is the best for representation, and what essentially delivers for the people of the Isle of Man. That's the framing of the conversation that we should be having.
Tanya, are you superfluous in Legislative Council? Surely to goodness, we've got 24 members in the House of Keys. Surely they can manage to undertake the functions of scrutiny and particularly legislative scrutiny. I mean, after all, that's why we elect politicians, is to change laws and change policies. Surely to goodness, the Keys should be up to that without the need for Legislative Council.
Everybody is good at different things, and the amount of the different hats that you have to wear as any one given parliamentarian, be that sort of in parliamentary scrutiny, which is different from the government work that you might do, which is different from the pre-legislative scrutiny that takes place in departments, which, by the way, is absolutely essential, and is different from the branch work that you might do, is different from the constituency work that you might do. Everybody is good at different things at different levels. But I do have to counter that with a question. How many times have you heard people like, say, for example, Chris Thomas turn around in the House of Keys and say, I'm sure that LegCo will fix it. And I hope that LegCo will look at this and look at that when, this piece of legislation is done in the House of Keys. I would like them to relook at this, relook at that, suggest this, suggest that. Perhaps they might take evidence on this or that. That has happened with so many pieces of legislation, and it's not just Chris. I'm picking him out probably because he's the loudest voice for change regarding Legislative Council. But that's happened on a very, very regular basis. And I do have to say, and apologise, Alistair, but I do have to say that the level of scrutiny that takes place from Legislative Council members currently, particularly across departments at the moment, we are represented across every single department, not because we all want to be, because quite frankly, I sit without a vote in two different departments, but I'm responsible for both programmes of legislation in two different departments. And I have categorically said on a number of occasions, it would be really nice, actually, if all members of Legislative Council were responsible for legislation in each of the departments to try and bring more legislation out of departments and to make sure that the pre-legislative scrutiny is right, the policies are right, the suggestions have been made to members of the House of Keys before these pieces of legislation land in branches. That a lot of that does take place now, but some of that is because some members, very few members of the House of Keys, they've been asked, will you join a department? And the response is, well, no.
And Tanya, you mentioned there that Chris Thomas and others use the, we haven't got this sorted, but let's hope LegCo does. If LegCo didn't exist, do you not think they would take their legislative priorities a little bit more seriously?
Potentially, yes. But then it doesn't necessarily mean that they would, they'll create. See, the best time to look at any piece of legislation is when it actually goes out to public consultation. So when the bill goes out to consultation, so that actually, instead of whatever might take place in the House of Keys, because you want everybody to know that you're doing a job, actually, you've got loads of time to work with officers to come to a compromise that is the best possible fit for the Manx public, for industry, for whatever that piece of legislation is trying to do. So everybody should be looking at legislation, really, as a legislator from that point, because then you've got an opportunity to actually change it before it hits the branch, and you're not in a rush when you're dealing with first, second clauses and third reading in the House of Keys, or with principles, evidence, clauses and final in LegCo. That is when you should be looking at legislation. That doesn't always take place. The vast majority of amendments, a lot of them, whether it be Keys or whether it be LegCo, is when the bills have already hit the branch. It's about, personally, the way that I feel about it, and is that we need to be looking at bills at a much earlier stage and taking interest in legislation at a much earlier stage. That's my view on it. But again, everybody's different, good at different things. That comes out in different ways in the House of Keys. They've also got constituency responsibilities. You have to have an awful lot of hats to be a parliamentarian on the Isle of Man.
Peter, then.
Can I just chip in on?
Yeah, certainly.
Things than that. I mean, you say, you know, there's 24 MHKs. Isn't that enough? If you look at the Isle of Man in comparative perspective, so you look at how many voters there are, for how many representatives there are per population across small democracies, which I work at, below 150,000 population, the Isle of Man is really, really low down on there. So a really small number of elected politicians in the national legislature for the country. If, say, all of the MLCs became MHKs instead, so you went back to a 13th century size House of Keys, it would still be well below Jersey and Guernsey, which in many ways are our close comparators. Mm. So I think to say, you know, well, there's already 24 MHKs is not quite capturing how spread out they are as a group, actually. And I suppose the other thing I would say is that we've had a bit of a discussion about process and the need to reflect on legislation. And one of the classic arguments in favour of bicameralism is this idea that you actually create a period of delay. You can't just rush it through one chamber, excepting emergencies. You create a period of delay and people look at things freshly. And in particular, there is a chance to involve civil society in that gap. So a piece of legislation, for instance, might come through the first chamber, be discussed, issues are raised, it appears in the press, people talk about it on social media, there's feedback, it then goes to the second chamber. So what can be seen as making everything a bit clunky and cumbersome, it's actually a feature of bicameralism, which is meant to produce better legislation in the end.
And yet, just before Christmas, we rushed through a fairly important piece of legislation in, was it a day, through both branches, I think it was, and that was in relation to gas regulation and particularly disconnecting people who had an inability to pay. And whereas I could kind of understand the need to rush through that bit, the need, there were other elements to that bill that were rushed through as well, which
I mean, I think rushed legislation stands a much greater chance of being bad legislation.
Yes.
And we saw some of that forced errors during the coronavirus crisis. You know, there was no alternative other than to take the speed that was taken, but there were definitely problems. But the danger, I think, is that if you have to have some mechanism for dealing very urgently with a particular problem. But the temptation by those driving a piece of legislation to try and get into that category is quite great. So in New Zealand, which is put forward as one of these great success stories of unicameralism, since it went unicameral in the 1950s, they have a really intricate and, I think, quite good system of select committees within their single chamber to really scrutinise legislation, all of which can be waived by a finding of urgency. And in the last 18 months, most bills have been found to be urgent bills. So this entire mechanism designed to improve the integrity of the process can just be pushed aside by urgency. So I absolutely agree, you've got to have it as something you can do, but if it gets abused, it creates really serious problems.
You're listening to Perspective with Tanya August Hansen, MLC, Nick Hawkes from Reuters, political commentator Alistair Ramsey, and Professor Edge from Oxford Brookes University. Well, let's go back then. Let's go back to the 13th century, because I'm quite fond of my history. The House of Keys originally, of course, included members from the Western Isles of Scotland, or at least Tynwald did, as far as we can tell. Initially, there were eight And then when we lost the Inner Hebrides, it dropped to 4, and then we lost the West, the Outer Hebrides, and sadly, they've been left to deteriorate over the centuries that have passed since then. I keep saying to various SNP politicians from the Western Isles of Scotland that there are still some seats on Tynwald Hill for them. So from that point, how did we end up with a tricameral parliamentary system?
So it gets quite murky, I think. But by the 1600s, I think it's fairly stabilised into a keys, which are seen in some sense as representative of the country. So they're not elected. They basically fall under the control of a relatively small number of gentry families in the Isle of Man, but they are seen to be a representative of the country, and a council, which is effectively the imperial superstructure that runs the Isle of Man. So the governor and all the officers appointed by the governor or by the crown. So that goes surprisingly late. You know, by the 19th century, elsewhere across the British Empire, that is being discarded in favour of what's called responsible government, where you have a directly elected chamber, which basically the province or the state mechanisms are responsible to. Isle of Man doesn't go that way. There is a suggestion that it might go that way a little bit when the Keys becomes elected, but actually the Lieutenant Governor and the Council remain very powerful for literally generations after that seismic change. And it's not until the 1910s, 1920s, there's real pressure to say, actually, the Keys need to be given a bigger role in this, the council needs to be looked at differently. The initial proposal was to replace the imperial officers on the council with directly elected officers, but a review commission said, actually, that's problematic. So what we'll move instead is to a hybrid system where you have some officers stay in place, for instance, the Deemsters. New members join, appointed by the Lieutenant Governor, who you would anticipate would be on the side of the imperial establishment, and a minority of the council are elected by the Keys themselves. And what we see throughout the 20th century is that all the other parts of the 1919 settlement, apart from the Lord Bishop, and if this goes out sufficiently late, that might be too late, apart from the Lord Bishop, have been removed and replaced by members elected by the Keys. And so that's how we get to the completely distinctive position we have today.
And of course, the situation with water in the Isle of Man has gone to the dogs since we lost the water bailiff from the Legislative Council. Apologies to anyone listening from MUA Water who's listening. So we developed effectively then. LegCo is a sort of a throwback to a time when we had effectively they were the Council of Ministers for all intents and purposes.
They were, but I wouldn't agree with that categorisation. Yes, you can trace its origins back to that imperial superstructure, but it really isn't that at all. You know, you had a separation from the council in its legislative and its executive roles in the mid-20th century, so that's why we call it LegCo rather than just the council. It used to be just called the council. So it's away from those roots. It's away from the very ancient roots. And one thing to really stress is, not as a result of legal change, but as a result of the change of the conduct of MHKs. We've gone from a position really up until 1995, 96, where becoming an MLC was seen as the culmination of a political career in the Keys. So, you know, the Keys would elect their own members or recent former members to become MLCs. That gradually shifted, and by the 2010s we reached a situation where the Keys are actually looking outside of Tynwald, so it's bringing members into the council, into Tynwald through the council, rather than simply shifting people who are already Tynwald insiders into a different part of the superstructure. So I would argue, really, if you're interested in the council, you need to be interested in the 21st century council and probably the post 2017 council.
Alistair, one of the suggestions that we hear from time to time from people who have watched Tynwald over many decades is that the move to effectively ditch LegCo as a home for a sort of retirement home for ex MHKs, and move to effectively people who have previously had little or no direct political experience. Some people suggest that perhaps we've lost a little by not having that kind of collective memory in LegCo. Is that a fair assessment?
I think I would agree with that. I think there is a lot of value in having former MHKs of the right type who have that experience and corporate memory, who are able to contribute and, you know, remind people of the follies of the past. But then equally, you need that needs to be balanced with kind of new blood and external perspectives. Arguably, it's gone too much the new blood way, which is not to say that the new people don't make a very valuable contribution. But I think the old concept of the elder statesman, we've kind of lost sight of that, and it's become unfashionable, and people can think it kind of looks bad that, you know, these guys are getting an easy retirement. But, you know, I mean, the one thing that I think Tim will be short of at the moment is that experience and corporate memory.
And, of course, Tanya, you are now becoming one of the experienced members, because you've probably been a member of Tyndall now for longer than many in the Keys.
Yeah, well, this is my seventh year now, so that time has flown. I do agree with Alistair that corporate memory is extraordinarily important, and that constitutional memory is extraordinarily important. We very much have that in Mr. Henderson at the moment, but I don't know how long we will have that for. What I don't agree with is that it's lacking in legislative council, because I do think that, you know, we've got myself and Kerry in there at the moment. We do have more senior members that, like, say, for example, Mr. Watterson, who's been in there, the Mr. Speaker, who's been there for quite a considerable amount of time. He's not somebody that we don't go to for advice and support. We very much do. We do with Mr. President as well, but Mr. Speaker has been extraordinary in terms of, you know, if there is an issue, then or we want to know about something, or we want to know the history of something, or we want to understand something a little bit better, we will go and speak to him about it. I do think that perhaps there is a wider, in terms of both Keys and Council, there is a wider perhaps lack of that corporate memory, though. I do agree with that. Legislative Council, I think, at this point in time has come about, I suppose, it's starting to come about because members of the House of Keys, and particularly at the start of this administration, looked at, well, what gaps have we got in the House of Keys that we need to fill with Legislative Council based on the types of things that we would like to be able to achieve. And that is, I think, quite an important piece of the puzzle. If you need somebody who is an expert, say, for example, in housing, then you will find those individuals. And also Legislative Council members are seeking to try and upskill as well at the same time. Not just myself, but there are other members of LegCo that, for example, have gone on the parliamentary governance course, a year-long course with McGill University. And we have, you know, sort of taken that course, got the certificate. I'm currently working on my master's degree as well for my legislative drafting, regulation and policy to try and upskill part-time in my own time. And I've nearly finished that now. But that's because I personally want to upskill, and I'm personally paying for that. So that there are other things that are falling into the mix, I think, in terms of providing other advantages where perhaps we have a slight disadvantage with corporate memory. But I do agree that, you know, members of the House of Keys that do have the right skill set for LegCo, I think that they are still a very, very important resource to be able to draw on and bring in if that's what they want.
Nick, do you think members of, particularly members of the House of Keys, understand the need to drive through legislative change? Because it, you know, certainly the first couple of years of this administration, there's hardly any legislation gone through.
I think it's hard. As you picked up before, you know, we're facing a huge number of crises in the Isle of Man. And as we've said, it's a small chamber forced to run effectively the entire governance of a much larger country and pass legislation on all things from health to transport to education. So there is limited time in the parliamentary calendar to do that. And quite often what you're faced with when you talk about constitutional reform or legislative reform is that idea of navel-gazing, is the idea that the system is good enough. And we've seen that with maybe, you know, Liz Vane's recommendations from 2016. A number of those didn't pass. And you can take the Liz Vane report, which was a big review into the functioning of Timwald, in a lot of different ways. A lot of people didn't like the recommendations which came through. One thing that I would pick up on, though, was that obviously there were recommendations around an appointments commission for Legislative Council. Yeah. Things like that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. What happens quite often, what we see, is that lofty attempts at reform get started or are driven through by individual members and then die. And they die for a number of reasons, you know, parliamentary time pressure. They might die because it's a personal kind of pet project. They might be shot down because it's seen as really inward looking and not delivering on policy. And we're seeing that with conversations around the bishop at the moment. You know, there's a lot of kind of name calling and a lot of maybe personal issues that are coming through the bishop's debate, which are detracting from that constitutional conversation. I think it is very much, though, an issue with capacity in the Keys, you know. But as I'll just go back to and say again, we don't think that we can just continue to ignore this. We don't think we can just continue to bolt on bits of into our constitution and think that this whole jumbled mess, thousand-year history, will continue to function particularly well. I think what we need to do is take a holistic view of how government operates. So in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to face a number of crises. We're going to continue to face crises. And there's going to come a time where government can't escape from the jumbled mess that's been created over the last 100,000 years. And it's going to have to act up and actually push through change.
Peter, maybe I'm asking the wrong question by asking whether House of Keys members understand the need. You know, one of their primary roles in Timwald in the House of Keys is to drive legislative change. That's what they're elected for. But most of the people doing the electing probably don't understand any of that, really. They don't get the importance of legislative change until something directly affects their lives and they say, well, this is crazy, this needs to change. It's part of the problem that public understanding, trying to somehow find a way in which the public can better understand why legislative change is a good thing.
Can I ask, when you're talking about legislative change, are you talking about legislative change to the constitution, the constitutional setup of Timwald, or are you talking about legislative change in terms of driving legislation through the branches?
Well, I'll use me as an example. I do occasionally. During my last the last two terms that I served in the House of Keys, I was probably top of the list in terms of numbers of bills that I managed to get through, and because I thought it was really important to change some of the legislation that I got through were bills that had been talked about for probably 20 years. And you think, you know, that talking about this is no good. And we were told, oh, Minister, it's very hard legislation, very complicated, takes a very long time. You can't possibly think that you could drive through legislation in a year or two. And is it, well, there is a sort of a mindset there, I think. But Peter, I mean, I don't know. I was asking you that question, and you pondered, which doesn't work so well on radio. is part of this problem that the public have maybe a limited understanding about how parliaments actually work and how governments actually work?
Yeah, I think there's a few things there. I mean, one is my impression is that the distinction between government and Timwald is still not completely clear in a lot of people's heads. Talking to politicians who reflected back on their experience of campaigning, they found that there was a lot of the things that constituents were interested in were really, really, really close to home. And so when you find somebody who simultaneously is having to address those concerns and also, for instance, decide the exact nature of the response to the aggressive action in Ukraine, for instance, and work out, well, where do we set the tax structures and work out how do we protect the infrastructure of communications, etc., it there's sort of a bit of a pull up towards the national and international issues, and yet at the same time, the remit of MHK goes down to a level which a UK MP would just find incomprehensible. So if you just, as an exercise, go through the order paper of a typical Timwald, you will see just how broad the issues being discussed are, even before you get into the work of the branches.
And it's not so much that it's the remit, is it? The detailed stuff is how, you know, the very low level, I suppose, in terms of how you'd see it maybe in national priority terms, that the low-level politics is what gets people elected, yeah. Whereas actually they are really elected to do the much higher-level stuff.
I think local and national works a lot better than lower and higher. Yeah. You know, think about what these are, things that really matter to people's lives, which is why they want to talk to their MHK about them to get them changed. So I think there is a really big ambit, which, going back to the point earlier about 24 not being all that many, is actually a problem. I suppose the other thing I would say is, you talk about MHKs and legislators being there to bring in new legislation. That's very tempting to agree with. But obviously the legislature is not simply there to produce novelty and innovation. There is an element of retaining what works well. And it doesn't map onto a straightforward left-right thing. You know, you will find some legislators who think there's an awful lot that needs urgent active change, and others who actually see more that they value in the current system. So I think pointing to legislative inactivity simply as a marker of apathy or failure is too simple.
And yet, I'll bring you in now, Tanya, the Housing Act is woefully out of date, and we seem to be incapable of bringing it up to date. We've got a housing crisis. Some of that is as a result of having out of date housing legislation.
Yeah, we've just finished working on the housing inquiry with the Poverty Committee, so we spent quite a bit of time talking to the Housing and Communities Board about their response to the recommendations, of which there are over 30 recommendations. And regarding housing and the housing issues that we've got on the Isle of Man, which are quite serious. I believe the Housing and Communities Board have got housing and miscellaneous provisions piece of legislation that they're looking to bring before the end of this administration.
And that, in effect, is an add-on to a bill which is, in most people's estimation, well past its sell-by date.
I don't know how they're going to choose to look at amending, or what that legislative design is going to look like. I've absolutely no idea. I'm not on the board. It's worth asking the chairman, David Ashford, about that. But I think that with big pieces of legislation, I think we're quite right. It's very, very easy, Professor Edge, to talk about the big shiny things that are coming through, like the big change that's coming through. There's also sat alongside all of that the legislative programme. And then alongside the legislative programme, there are a bunch of uncommenced, pieces of legislation or parts of legislation sat on a list as well. And then alongside that, there are a bunch of pieces of legislation that perhaps have not had the opportunity even to be looked at. Nobody's considering them. No, and then there are other things that just need consolidating, like, for example, the constitution legislation, of which we have a number of pieces. There's so much in and of that mix, but we do have a legislative programme. The back end of the last administration, I worked alongside colleagues and officers and drafters on the domestic abuse legislation, the sex offences legislation, justice reform. There were a number of really big, meaty pieces of legislation that needed secondary. Now, all of the instructing officers that are sat in departments, they worked on those pieces of primary. They now need to work on the pieces of secondary, which is why you end up kind of like with this little bit of a lag at the start of an administration, because they're trying to implement and get these pieces of legislation in place with policy guidance attached to it, training attached to that. There's been a lot with sex offences, particularly in terms of training. I know I've talked to the Justice Minister, Jane Paul Wilson, about that. There's a lot else that's being done, and they're all being done by the same people, exactly the same people. I think that there are one or two people in the Department of Home Affairs, for example, that are working on sex offences and domestic abuse, that they've been working on those, that are now implemented and now working and now running. There's a lot of other legislation that perhaps I would have expected to have come through that hasn't yet come through. So we're waiting. And as a legislative council, that's the reason why we ended up developing the post-legislative scrutiny side of it, in looking at pieces of legislation that are, you know, about 2 years afterwards and thereafter, pieces of legislation, to try and see if actually you go back to the principles, look at them as criteria for a full understanding of or assessment of whether or not that piece of legislation is doing what it was supposed to do in the first place. So we've only just started doing that, and we're doing that with the charities registration regulation legislation. So that is starting to happen. LegCo trying to fill some of that gap with their time, because they're not getting the branch work through that they were expecting to get. So there are a number of different elements to all of that. I don't think that there's a lack of enthusiasm or drive. I know that we talk about a lack of enthusiasm and drive in the House of Keys. I think people do want pieces of legislation. I know that there are two private members' bills from one individual that are coming through from the House of Keys. And then there's another one from Dr. Allinson, another one from Laurie Hooper. So there is an interest in it, but I was expecting to see perhaps a little bit more from government, in honesty, and saying that I'm also on the Council of Ministers Legislative Subcommittee, so but we monitor, we don't manage, so
Alistair, bearing in mind the perilous state of the government finances, would you have expected that, because it would appear the opposite is the case, but would you have expected that we would have more legislation which enables others to do, as opposed to what tends to happen with legislation, which is we've introduced this new law and now we need a huge additional expenditure, several more officers to undertake the work that this new law has created?
Do you mean legislation that kind of outsources functions?
Possibly outsourcing functions or reduces the need for the bureaucracy. It's a very rare thing for a government to introduce. I mean, often politicians talk about the need to cut red tape and bureaucracy, but they very rarely introduce legislation that streamlines and simplifies.
Yeah. I think one of the curious things about this administration is their apparent lack of interest in even addressing the size of government or the increase in government staff or increase in government expenditure. The perception is that they're very kind of free spending, and they're kind of investing in the future is the new word for overspending. And whether they are doing anything behind the scenes, I don't know. But so I wouldn't really expect them to be addressing that in any really serious way.
Because the answer to our financial situation seems to be we just need more taxes.
We need more people paying taxes. That's the approach. So it's kind of throwing bodies at the problem. Which brings me back to the point about big changes in legislation. You can have big changes that don't actually need or don't need immediately any legislation. So that the massive change that we've seen in this administration is the economic strategy and the actual setting of a goal of a larger population, and everything is going hell for leather to achieve that. I'm not aware that there's been any legislation supporting that. I mean, it'll probably feed into the strategic plan in due course, and that's probably what it's all about. But,
And now another complicated question perhaps for Peter, but bearing in mind where we are in the world with many of the advanced countries, you know, the countries that have been seen to be relatively stable with relatively stable finances, actually many of these countries starting to struggle to actually pay for all the functions that they carry out. Can we continue on the sort of trajectory we've been on in the past of continuing to expand the role and functions of governments through more and more legislation, or is there going to be a point where someone says, actually, we need to wake up and smell the coffee here? We're doing more than we can possibly do. We can't legislate for every single situation, and it's time to reverse some of this.
I'm going to be very brief because I'm not an economist, I'm a lawyer, but I think there's a distinction between legislating for something and regulating something. So you can have a situation where the democratically elected force within the country says, okay, these are the rules by which people must play. That isn't necessarily the same as, and therefore we need to have a new unit to deal with this, because sometimes you will find that some of the regulatory functions, which without doubt have grown across the West since 1945, some of the regulatory functions can be dealt with by existing mechanisms. So I think it really is a challenge, and I would also put it in a post-colonial challenge. You know, you have a system where a lot of Western European democracies were largely propped up by colonialism. And as you move away from that, as it changes forms, as perhaps it begins to attenuate, things look very different in this part of the world.
Tanya?
I do think there are, like, you know, there are a number of different things that have cropped up over the course of this administration, and the conversations that have been had are many, in which, you know, it's like, oh, we need legislation for this, we need legislation for that. And it's like, actually, no, you don't need legislation for it. You can do it via this mechanism or that mechanism, or actually, you don't need legislation at all. I agree with Professor Edge. There is a very, very stark distinction between legislating for something and regulating something. I'll leave it at that.
Nick, then, you're one of the instigators of this discussion. What do you hope to achieve from all of this?
I think really it touches on quite a lot of what's already been discussed. You know, we have a very small political class in the Isle of Man who have the same conversations, they fill in the same consultations, they phone into the man in line. It's the same kind of discussions. And I think if we want to create better policy, if we want to address some of the issues of government overspend or policy direction, then we need to expand out that franchise. You know, we need to be able to have more conversations. We need to bring more people into those conversations. One of the ways to do that is through greater political education, because that knowledge doesn't exist. You know, the functions and form of legislative council, how it compares with other countries around the world, it's lacking. And that's not because, you know, people won't understand it. It's because, you know, it's quite often seen as an afterthought for a lot of people. It functions in the background, and if it's not broke, don't fix it. But it plays a huge part in all of our lives, or the people who live in the Isle of Man's lives, rather. But it plays a huge part in all of our lives in terms of the role that they play, because it's a small chamber. We have a small parliament deciding some very big issues that affect Manx people on the daily. So there needs to be more of a focused discussion around that. And one way to improve that discussion and improve the outcomes of that discussion is to get more people into it. So that's what we hope to do. We don't want to tell people, you know, we should abolish LegCo. We don't want to tell people we should have a unicameral system. That is a bigger discussion. That's something for the future, and that's something we'd aspire to see. Conversations about how policy should work, conversations about the structure of government, they need to be had in a very phased and structured way. We can't rush into them, because then we'll have many unintended consequences. So what we want to do is start that debate, because it has been lacking in the Isle of Man. And if we can play a part in that, if we can get those conversations going, I think we'll say that our job is done.
And do you think it's going to be easy to get people motivated, to actually encourage greater political discourse with the public?
I think it will be. I think there's a couple of reasons to that, and it certainly has been in the past when we've seen other attempts at this, or even if you look at kind of the more traditional engagement mechanisms, if you look at local authority elections, if you look at the kind of people that turn out to political conferences or turn up to vote in a general election, you know, it is a challenge to get people to engage in politics in the Isle of Man. Something that we really need to do is focus more on political education of all ages. We need to encourage people to understand their system. It's quite easy to just frame the Manx political system as a discount version of Westminster, you know, because our media is so heavily influenced by the UK, because the colour scheme is very similar in the Keys and in LegCo. You know, it's quite easy to make those parallels and to think, well, actually, look, you know, Westminster does a lot of this stuff, when actually domestically the Isle of Man does a lot of the stuff that Westminster does. You know, we have a huge amount of autonomy. So getting people to that point of understanding is the first hurdle. And that takes effort. That takes time, that takes money, and it will require some effort from government and from Tynwald and from political parties and from the media. and hopefully also from Rietis, to encourage people to start to take that journey of political understanding.
And you mentioned there, and sadly that is the end of the programme, but you mentioned there local government. And of course, we've got many elected representatives in local government, obviously who don't engage in legislation, but they do engage in local policy making. And perhaps that's a topic for a future Rietis discussion.
Definitely on the agenda.
I was joined in the studio by Tanya August Hansen, MLC, Nick Hawkes from Rietis, political commentator Alistair Ramsey, and Professor Peter Edge from Oxford Brookes University. Are you in the political navel-gazing camp, or do you think reform is essential to make politics work better for the Manx people? I'm Phil Gorn. Goram Mayo San Geisachrom. Thanks for listening.